Okay, excellent. I will have the marshal. Please call the next case.
Now calling A23-1613, State of Minnesota, respondent versus Elijah Willard James Gwynn, Sr., defendant, Midwest Bonding LLC, appellant.
Thank you, Marshall. And again, we are here on zoom.gov for our arguments today on April 11th. We're about to hear the third of our three cases scheduled for oral argument today, the third and final. And we only have counsel for appellant. It's in light of the fact that respondent did not file a brief. So there will only be 15 minutes for your primary argument. And can you see the clock in the upper left-hand corner?
I can, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay, great. So that clock will be tracking your time for today. Counsel, in addition, just I want to recall that it would be helpful for our oral audio recording, sorry, to have you identify yourself and your client at the beginning of your argument. And if you have any issues with the technology, please don't hesitate to let me know. We'll take a moment to make sure that you can that we can hear you correctly and move on from there. But don't be shy about giving a holler if that's the case. So with that, there are 15 minutes on the clock, and you may begin when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. Can the court hear me okay on all accounts? I see affirmative nods. Thank you. Good morning. My name is Jim McGeaney, MC capital G E E N E Y, and I appear on behalf of the appellant in this matter, Midwest Bonding LLC. May it please the court, I'm here arguing that the district court abused its discretion in denying my client's petition to reinstate and discharge the bail bonds in this matter by order dated June 7th of 2023. I won't go too much into the facts of this case, but I will point out that we are arguing that the district court not only made errors of law in its order, but also errors of fact. Specifically, the error of fact is the district court cites the length of the defendant's absence, which would go to the first Shetsky factor. I won't take this court's time in going through the Shetsky factors. I've briefed them. I'm certain that the court's familiar with those. But the first Shetsky factor, of course, does deal with the length of the defendant's absence. I think the record is clear, even in the district court's order, that the defendant was absent from the jurisdiction on the bond at issue here for 56 days.
Can I ask you about that? Because there's two bonds at issue here, right? There's the 042108 and 015573. Is that right?
That's correct, John. I misspoke when I said bond. So it is there are two
So,
bonds.
but I wanted to ask you how you got the 56-day calculation, because the first bond, the 042108, that was posted on June 16th, 2021, if I understand it correctly. And then Mr. Gwynn failed to appear on July 16th, 2021, and a warrant was issued. He's taken back into custody in August 4th, 2021. There's another bond that's not at issue in this appeal posted by Midwest, by your client. And he then fails to appear at the following hearing in September. Midwest tries to get the petitions reinstated and discharged. And then Mr. Gwynn continues to fail to appear. So I'm wondering, are you counting from this only from the second bond when it was forfeited in November of 2022, that 56 days? Why shouldn't we also consider? Because actually, the district court might have undercounted if we look at both bonds and the time out. Can you explain that to me?
Well, I was calculating the time from the November 1st, 2022 failure to appear.
Isn't that just on the second bond, though? Or is
I
that on
suppose you're
both?
right, Your Honor, on the second bond. I would agree, and I'd have to concede I miscalculated on the first bond. The district court, in its order, indicated that it was not considering our request to reinstate and discharge the $5,000 bond because it had issued an order forfeiting that bond previously, and in its order that's on appeal, declined to consider that bond. So I think technically we're probably only arguing on the $25,000 bond in this case. We never did appeal that prior order, the $5,000 forfeit that Judge Eichenwald said was a final order and not subject to further review in her order. So because she cites that that order was already decided and not appealed, I don't know that I could necessarily ask this court to reverse that order on the $5,000 bond, as you point out. So the 56 days is from the November 1st failure to appear after the second bond was posted, the $25,000 bond. Does that answer the court's question?
Well, I think I understand what you're saying, and it sounds like you're conceding that any appeal from the 42108 bond is essentially waived, and you want us to focus our attention on the $25,000 bond ending in 15573. But my follow-up question now is, when it's one company posting these multiple bonds, why should we only focus on the 56 days? I mean, it's your client throughout, and you know, ostensibly your brief had tried to argue both bonds, and it's, you know, I think I counted correctly, 9 months, maybe more, between the two of them, that he is not appearing and is in abscond status. So, I mean, it seems to me like one of your strongest arguments is this shorter period of time in relation to some of the cases you point out, that it's a longer period of time, but it's one company posting multiple bonds for one person who just would not come to court. So why shouldn't we consider that other period of time?
Well, I'm not aware of any case law that suggests that prior bond forfeitures and reinstatements are factors to be considered. You know, Minnesota continues to be a right to bail state under our constitution. And I've argued this before other panels, I guess. And the district court's order, by the way, I think is generally critical of Midwest history of posting bonds for this defendant. But the defendant has the right to have bail, and certainly the right to post a bail bond regardless of his history. I think that the prior history, Your Honor, is taken into consideration when the district court sets bail. And that's the factors under Rule 6 of the Rules of Criminal Procedure in determining how much bond to set on a new appearance after that history. I don't know that the law favors a review or consideration of a client's failure history on other bonds in applying the factors in this bond. So I'm not aware of any law that favors that. Now, I suppose it could be considered in the good faith. I think the district court cites that good faith position, saying the Midwest is not acting in good faith. But what would be the difference if another bond company had posted those other bonds than Midwest? I don't know that you'd be asking me that question. And so the fact that Midwest happens to be the bond company that posts these more recent bonds, I don't think it should be considered. I think the analysis goes from the time the bond at issue is posted until the time that it's forfeited, regardless of the prior history.
So, Mr. McGinney, when I read the district court's order, I don't read it just criticizing your client for issuing the additional bonds. I read it as criticizing your company for issuing additional bonds without creating additional safeguards. I think those are the words of the district court, which is different. I mean, wouldn't you agree that's a reasonable way to read the district court's order?
I think that's true. I think that's it. The court does take great length at criticizing Midwest for not ensuring that the offender appears, right? And this court, I don't have a published opinion, but there's numerous unpublished opinions, and I cite one in my brief. It's a case that I argued where this court has held and repeatedly held that the surety has no obligation to take safeguards or take steps to ensure an offender appears, that the obligation of the surety is after the failure to appear. I know there are several district court judges that take great issue with that state of the law right now. And I've had lots of arguments in the district courts about that. But right now, that is the state of the law in Minnesota, which is why we argue that Judge Eichenwald's analysis is lawfully erroneous, that she's got an her view that the surety some way has an obligation to, what she says multiple times, minimize the risk of an offender failing to appear. I argue to this court, there is no obligation to a surety to minimize the risk. And there's really no way to do that. How do you minimize the risk? You know, bail bonds are overseen by the Department of Commerce because they're basically insurance policies. And I think the district courts in their analysis at an appearance and setting bail analyze the risk.
But can I just, I mean, isn't there, there's, I understand the argument you're making, but there's a factual issue here, right? Because didn't the court at one point reinstate the bond before Mr. Gwynn appeared? And then Mr. Gwynn, he had failed to appear. The court reinstated the bond, and then he didn't appear at the next court appearance. Isn't that part of the procedural history of this case?
I don't know that that's part of the record, Your Honor. I could tell this court, and it's going to be a long answer to a short question.
He failed to appear December 14, 2021. The court issued a warrant. May 11th, court held a hearing on your client's request to reinstate. These are different bonds. Actually, it includes one of the bonds that you appealed, the 42108. And then the court ordered both bonds reinstated, and if Midwest could recover the defendant and bring him back into the jurisdiction within 90 days, it would revoke and discharge. And then he was back in custody. The Midwest filed another petition to reinstate and discharge in August, but in September posted the 25,000 bond, and then he failed to appear. So it's a little more complicated to say minimize the risk is putting it, the burden on your client to ensure a court appearance when your client's clearly on notice that this person has a problem with failing to appear. The court gives your client the benefit of the doubt, reinstates prior to the court appearance, and he fails to appear again. So why isn't that a nuance that rebuts the argument you're making about the court getting the law wrong on this one?
Well, I think the record's a little murky there. And I was about to tell the court that in St. Louis County, they have a regular practice when people fail to appear of ordering a bond be forfeited, but not entering it on the record, and then waiting until the formal order forfeiting the bond is issued. So my client doesn't have notice that the bond had been forfeited. And then oftentimes, and it might be the case here, the actual order forfeiting the bond happens when the defendant is apprehended.
But that's not this case because the your client had filed a petition to reinstate the forfeited bond in May of 2022. I think
that's the $5,000 bond that the court's referring, not the $25,000 bond, because the $25,000 bond wasn't posted until, I'll have to look at the review affidavit, but I think because there are multiple bonds, the bond at issue here.
Well, you were arguing both at that time to the court, right? I mean, you were arguing both $5,000 and $25,000. So why isn't it fair for the court to consider that in its analysis when it talks about minimizing risk?
Well, again, back to the point that we were arguing both because we were in front of the district court making that argument at the time. But the minimizing the risk, in a sense, it's saying you shouldn't post a subsequent bond. Right. You're taking the risk on by posting a new bond after there's been a failure to appear and you haven't apprehended the defendant. Minimizing the risk, I'm not sure what the district court expects to be done to minimize the risk of a failure to appear. What actions can a surety take to, quote, minimize the risk other than not post an additional bond? I think that's the gist of the court's frustration with Mr. Gwynn and Midwest bonding. But The $25,000 bond was posted in June of 21. And then it was in November of 22 that the failure to appear was recorded in the record that we received a forfeiture notice on that bond. So that prior history of the court that the court addresses in its order is kind of St. Louis County's inter-county practice of not actually formally ordering the bond forfeited on the record, but just telling the parties at the hearing that we're going to forfeit this bond if you don't bring this defendant into custody. So again, I don't, it goes back to the argument that the bond company or the surety here is being scrutinized for posting additional bonds after there's been prior forfeitures or failures to appear. It's our position, it's my argument that those are ancillary. They're not at issue in the fact in the analysis under Schatzky. Other than you could maybe infer bad faith, but what would be the difference again if another bond company had posted all those other bonds? Is a new bond company acting in bad faith by fulfilling the defendant's right to be out released on bail as the Minnesota Constitution guarantees? So I know I'm about out of time. I don't know if I've answered your question adequately, but I don't think those prior bonds should be considered. Here, the district court basically finds the Schatzky factors are not satisfied because Midwest didn't take pre-hearing steps to ensure the offender appeared. And this court has held in numerous cases that that's not something that the surety is obligated to do under the Schatzky factors. It's post failure to appear. And here we did everything that we could have done post failure to appear. For what it's worth, it's not in the record, and I probably won't. I won't start arguing facts not on the record, so I'll leave it at that. And I'm out of time. Thank you.
Well, thank you, counsel, for your argument here today. Thank you for your brief. It is helpful. And we will deem the case submitted and issue an opinion within the statutory time frame.